And what we're going to be talking about is litigation and remedies against debt collectors under the FDCPA. And we're going to touch on various subjects here, such as increasing FDCPA individual awards. I'm not going to go into class actions because you guys aren't going to be dealing with that. But there's a wide range of parties that you can bring into FDCPA actions. A wide range of defendants may be named. And there's some of these things that with what we're doing, people need to know about these things. So we're going to touch on some of this stuff tonight here. So as I usually do, I'm going to go ahead and mute everyone at this point in time. We will do our education hour, and then we will come back for comments and questions after that. So everybody has been muted. All right, let's talk about considerations concerning remedies. And one of those is increasing FDCPA individual awards. Most FDCPA cases historically have been based on violations in Dunning letters. A false threat, an improper notice, a misstatement of the amount of the debt, things like that. This approach has provided the advantage of the streamlined suit, often seeking only statutory damages and attorney's fees without contested facts, with liability often decided on summary judgment. Such suits require minimal discovery and result in a judgment with relative speed. With the passage of time since the enactment of the FDCPA, however, the real value of statutory damages under the FDCPA has declined substantially because the $1,000 ceiling in individual actions and the $500,000 ceiling in class actions have remained unchanged since 1977. Think they may need to adjust that. In addition, the deterrence and compliance objectives of the private attorney general enforcement mechanism. Now, I want to stop for a minute. Private attorney general enforcement mechanism. Each one of you, when you bring an action under the FDCPA, are acting as a private attorney general. Please keep that in mind. The private attorney general enforcement mechanism have to some extent been successful over the years, and the frequency and regularity of some types of written violations have decreased. The whole idea of using private attorneys general, in other words, letting us bring the actions, is so the government isn't swamped with having to deal with that themselves. One strategy to increase FDCPA awards in individual actions is to focus on cases that involve egregious debt collector abuse and the resulting significant consumer injury. An award of punitive damages in such cases pursuant to a state law claim will further enhance the consumer's recovery. Another strategy is to focus on cases with overcharges and seek those overcharges as actual damages for the class. Now, here again, that's only if you're dealing with class actions. Another possibility to produce a sizable actual damages award is bringing an FDCPA case alleging litigation misconduct by a debt buyer or other collector in bringing prior collection action against the consumer or a class of consumers. The consumer's actual damages may include the attorney fees the consumer had to expend to prevail in a collection action or other costs to defend the suit. All right. Now, let's go on to there's a wide range of parties that may bring FDCPA actions. A private right of action is available not only to the consumer, that is, the putative debtor, but also to any person adversely affected by an FDCPA violation. Now remember, if somebody is bothering you because they're trying to find someone else, you're not the debtor, but you can bring FDCPA actions against them. All right. Actually, there's a couple citations here I'm going to give you for that. I'm going to read that sentence again, and then I'll give you a couple citations. A private right of action is available not only to the consumer, that is, the putative debtor, but also to any person adversely affected by an FDCPA violation. And you have Villarreal, spelled V-I-L-L-A-R-R-E-A-L, versus Snow. It's a 1996 decision out of the Northern District of Illinois. And the footnote here is, individual who was not actually obligated had signed as owner of the collateral for a loan and was an addressee of the deceptive Dunning letters. Jeez. All right. Moreover, most FDCPA provisions protect not just consumers, but everyone affected by violations occurring during the collection of consumer debts. Therefore, friends, relatives, neighbors, or an employer, even though not obligated or alleged to be obligated on a debt, may bring an action under the Act. That's pretty interesting. Give you a couple citations here. Heard, spelled H-E-A-R-D, versus Bonneville, B-O-N-N-E-V-I-L-L-E, Billing and Collections. That's a Tenth Circuit case from 2000. And there is also West versus Costen, spelled C-O-S-T-E-N. And that is from the Western District of Virginia. And that is a little bit older case from 1983. All right, the equities of a case may be improved with the joinder of non-debtor plaintiffs whose claims may create additional sympathy. Now, that's a new interesting thought. The equities of a case may be improved with the joinder of non-debtor plaintiffs. If you've got somebody else that's been injured with somebody trying to collect something from you, have the other people join the case as plaintiffs. An executor of a deceased party also has standing to bring an FDCPA claim that the deceased could have brought. Isn't that interesting? And there's actually several citations on that. I'll give you a couple of them. Wright, spelled W-R-I-G-H-T, versus Financial Services Incorporated. And that's a Sixth Circuit decision from 1993. And another case is Kashek, spelled K-A-S-C-H-A-K versus Raritan, R-A-R-I-T-A-N, Valley Collection Agency. And that is a 1989 case out of the District of New Jersey. All right, let's go on. There's a wide range of defendants may be named under the FDCPA. Employees and officers. See, a lot of people wonder, and I get questions about this, and I think this is good to try and get this on the recording here and get this information out, because I have people question me all the time. You know, well, you know, who can we include in this stuff? The FDCPA defines debt collector to include any person who regularly collects debts, and therefore coverage is not limited to collection agencies. despite dicta in a Seventh Circuit decision, in other words, what is said, that's what dicta means. Apparently not even followed in the Seventh Circuit, and there's a footnote there. Agency employees and officers are individually liable under the Act to the extent to which they participate in the FDCPA violation. Okay, let's give you a couple case citations on that. Kistner, K-I-S-T-N-E-R, versus Law Offices of Michael P. Margalevsky. I'm going to spell that one. M-A-R-G-E-L-E-F-S-K-Y, LLC. And that's a Sixth Circuit decision from 2008. And there is another one. Tinison, spelled T-H-I-N-E-S-E-N, versus J-B-C Legal Group Professional Corporation. And that is a 2005 decision from the District of Minnesota. All right, liability is based upon these individuals' participation in the violation, though, and not simply on their association with the collection agency. Now, that's real important to pay attention to here. Liability is based upon these individuals' participation in the violation and not simply on their association with the collection agency. So if you are dealing with, wanting to go after additional people, they're going to have to have been, to have played some part in the violations that you're dealing with. Now, this actually can be as a result of supervisory operations, and I believe that we go into that here shortly. Corporate officers and members of law firms may be named as individual defendants where they are personally involved in establishing or carrying out the prescribed activities of the corporation or law firm. In other words, if you're a principal of the law firm, you're involved in establishing or carrying out the prescribed activities of the corporation. You lay down the rules by which the law firm is supposed to operate. Therefore, you incur liability. And actually, a case citation on that is one that I just gave you a little bit ago, Kistner versus Law Offices of Michael P. Margalevsky. And then I'll give you another one. I'm having a hard time seeing this. Albanese, spelled A-L-B-A-N-E-S-E, versus Portnoff, spelled P-O-R-T-N-O-F-F, Law Associates Limited. And that is from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, 2004. The fiduciary shield doctrine does not insulate officers or employees who determine how collections are conducted. Get you a couple citations here. Bruis, spelled B-R-U-J-I-S, versus Shaw, S-H-A-W. That is a 95 case out of the Northern District of Illinois. And that's the only one that we've got there. Okay. Even if officers are not directly involved in the collection efforts, they can be liable if they exercise supervisory authority over the corporation, are intimately involved with the practices and procedures of the corporation, or developed and implemented the particular collection practice challenged. This is very important because this is giving you the teeth for going after these other people, and you need to understand how they can be tied in. And there's a couple of citations here. Brumbelow, spelled Brumbelow, versus Law Offices of Bennett, spelled Bennett, and Deloney, spelled Deloney, professional corporation. That came from the District of Utah in 2005. And then there is Musso, spelled M-U-S-S-O, versus Siders, spelled S-E-I-D-E-R-S. And that's the District of Connecticut from 1999. And this is important here. I'm going to give you one more citation here. Pope, P-O-P-E, versus Vogel, V-O-G-E-L. That is Northern District of Illinois from 1998. And now, pay attention to this one. I read this one earlier, and it's like, okay. An attorney in a sole proprietorship should be individually liable in addition to the sole proprietorship's liability. Get the lawyer and his law business. I've got two citations. One of them is the one that I gave earlier, Kistner, K-I-S-T-N-E-R, versus Law Offices of Michael P. Margalefsky. That's Sixth Circuit, 2008. Now, there's another citation in here that states it's contra. This may be an opinion that went the other way. You'll want to take a look at it, and that is Bartlett, B-A-R-T-L-E-T-T, versus Herbel, spelled H-E-R-B-L. That's a Seventh Circuit case from 1997. While most debt collection employees and officers are impecunious, boy, I'd have to look up that word, and that word is impecunious. That would be a good one. In fact, I'm going to mark that with my highlighter here. I want to know what that means. Here, impecunious. Others, such as a person who is both the owner and actively involved in the collection activities of a small company, may be wealthier than the company itself. Joining as a party, an employee or officer involved in the debt collection also facilitates discovery, which is typically more expensive and cumbersome against a non-party. Care should be taken that the employee not be one that may solicit undue sympathy from a jury. Now, that makes sense. And that, again, goes back. The case citation on that is the Kistner Law Offices
Kistner versus Law Offices of Michael Magalewski. Because collection employees often use fake names while collecting a debt, it may be necessary to sue them as John Doe, a.k.a., and for those of you that don't know what A period K period A means, also known as, is what that stands for, Robert Smith. And discovery may be needed to obtain the information necessary to serve them. So sometimes if you've got somebody that you want to sue but you don't have them by name, what you've got to do is start your lawsuit with the other people involved, and then you move into discovery and go into discovery to discover the name of the individual that you're really wanting to add to it so that you can get their real name through the discovery process and then add them as a defendant. Okay, owners, partners, franchisers, and parent companies. By piercing the corporate veil, the owner of a collection agency may be held liable for FDCPA violations committed by agency employees. Gee, we always want to be able to find as many targets as we can that are involved in this. If there is sufficient evidence to pierce the veil. Now, that's one of the things. If there is sufficient evidence to pierce the veil. Okay, I've got a couple cases here. KLCO versus Elmhurst, spelled E-L-M-H-U-R-S-T, Dodge. And that's a Northern District of Illinois, 2002, citation. And we have Byes, spelled B-Y-E-S, versus Accelerated Cash Flow Incorporated. And that is from the Eastern District of Louisiana, from 1996. In addition, even if owners are not directly involved in the collection efforts, they can still be liable if they exercise supervisory authority over the corporation, are intimately involved with the practices and procedures of the corporation, or developed and implemented the particular collection practice challenged, which, you know, basically we've already mentioned that back there. Under partnership law, the general partners of limited partnership debt collection agencies are vicariously liable for the limited partnership's violations. A franchisor may be liable for those acts of its franchisee debt collector, which it controls. That's only if they control them. And there's actually a case citation for that. Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, versus Checkwrite, C-H-E-C-K-R-I-T-E. Limited. That's Southern District of Ohio, 1986. A parent company can be found liable. There's an extra word in here, funny thing. Every once in a while I run into a typo. Can be found liable for the FDCPA violations of its corporate subsidiary collection agency, even where the subsidiary collects debts in the subsidiary's own name. Now, that's interesting. If you're dealing with a debt collection company that's got a hierarchy, and you start getting into some of these where there's, this company buys a bunch of the debt and then they fan it out to other people. Here it is. A parent company can be found liable for the FDCPA violations of its corporate subsidiary collection agency, even where the subsidiary collects debts in the subsidiary's own name. So LVNV
if they're collecting for somebody, or if LVNV is funneling it down and others are collecting, go after the people up the food chain. There's no case citation on that. This liability can be shown where the subsidiary was merely an instrumentality for the parent, and the entire group of corporations constituted a single economic enterprise. And boy, there's a bunch of citations for this. I'm going to give you several. Jenkins versus Union Corp. And that is from the Northern District of Illinois, 1998. And says here, the parent corporation could be liable, but in this case, insufficient evidence to create such liability was produced. And see, another thing I want to mention again, when you see where somebody loses a case, don't think, oh, well, I don't want to look at that. I'm not going to learn anything from it. That is not the right viewpoint to have. When you see where somebody lost a case, go and read it, because you can find out why they lost it. They will point out why they lost it, and it'll help you to avoid getting into the same trap, to make sure you cover the bases. So you can learn from the losing cases just as much as you can learn from the winning ones. So don't think that you don't want to look at those losing cases when you find them. All right, here's another case, Avila, spelled A-V-I-L-A, versus Van, V-A-N, Rue, R-U, Credit Corporation. And this is from the Northern District of Illinois from 1995. And I'm going to give you one more here. United States versus ACB, Alice Charlie Brown, Sales and Service Incorporated. That's a 1984 case from the District of Arizona. All right. Now let's go on here. I'm going to touch on, there's one quick little note here. Joining parties otherwise exempt from FDCPA liability. Creditors are generally exempt from FDCPA liability, so a state claim is usually the best course of action to challenge the creditor's debt collection activities. In other words, do it in the state instead of the federal. Creditors and others exempt from the FDCPA may be joined as co-defendants in a federal court FDCPA action against a collection agency if the court accepts supplemental jurisdiction over state law claims against these other parties. Just a quick note there. All right, let's talk a little bit about the trial by jury here. You know, we always talk about, you know, you want to ask for a trial by jury. The Seventh Amendment to the United States Constitution guarantees the right to a jury trial in FDCPA private actions seeking actual or statutory damages. Collectors have argued that the use of the word court in 15 U.S.C. 1692K and so on and so forth, and evidenced a congressional intent to limit FDCPA actions to bench trials. This argument has been consistently rejected. If you ever run into a situation where they are trying to say, well, you know, you don't get a jury trial for this kind of stuff, that is incorrect. They've been consistently rejected. I'll give you a couple case citations. Cobbs, spelled K-O-B-S, versus
Arrow, A-R-R-O-W, Service Bureau Incorporated. It's a Seventh Circuit case from 1998. There is Sibley, S-I-B-L-E-Y, versus Fulton, DeKalb, D-E-K-A-L-B, Collection Service. And that's 11th Circuit from 1982. So when they want to argue jury, forget it. The word court is not the equivalent of the word judge and is used in numerous federal statutes to include both the judge and jury in circumstances that merely beg the Seventh Amendment question. As an FDCPA action is similar to types of actions recognized in common law, the Seventh Amendment guarantees the right to a jury trial to any party in an FDCPA action seeking damages. It's just the way it is. Okay, let's talk about actual damages. Because, you know, and we're going to talk about a couple of different things here. And this is important because we've been getting more and more questions on these. We're going to talk some about emotional distress damages. And that's one of the big ones that a lot of people claim. And then I want to touch on proof of actual damages, because these are all very important. This provision establishes a cause of action for actual damages sustained by any person as a result of a failure of a collector to comply with any FDCPA provision. That's any provision in it. Neither the FDCPA nor any other part of the Consumer Credit Protection Act defines actual damage. Now, that's interesting. I'm going to read that again. Neither the FDCPA nor any other part of the Consumer Credit Protection Act defines actual damage. Black's Law Dictionary defines actual damages as, quote, an amount awarded to a complainant to compensate for a proven injury or loss, damages that may repay actual losses, also termed compensatory damages, unquote. Congress left it to the courts to apply the term actual damages or actual damage to particular cases in accordance with the purposes of the FDCPA and with developing principles of federal common law. Actual damages commonly include pecuniary losses, such as lost wages or the cost of obtaining an unlisted telephone number, and physical injuries, such as heart attacks, ulcers, vomiting, and insomnia. Well, there's quite a list there. In addition, the courts commonly allow recovery of damages for emotional distress. That's very important. And relational injuries under the FDCPA. Decisions awarding actual damages for these and other types of harm caused by abusive debt collection are discussed in another section of the book here. Okay, emotional distress damages. This is one of the common ones that claims, you know, oh, the harassment of the phone calls and all the Dunning letters and this and that and so on and so forth. All right. Courts generally agree that emotional distress damages can be awarded under the FDCPA without having to meet state tort requirements for recovery of emotional distress damages. And boy, are there case citations on this. I'm going to give you about four or five of them because this is important. If you're claiming emotional damages, you're going to have the lawyers fight you, and you want to have some ammunition. So here's some ammunition. Johnson, and it's J-O-H-N-S-O-N, versus McCullough, spelled M-C, capital C-O-L-L-O-U-G-H. That is a Ninth Circuit case from 2011. We have Ortega, O-R-T-E-G-A, versus Collectors Training Institute of Illinois, Inc. And that's from the Southern District of Florida, 2011. Here's a real interesting name. Poniewoz, spelled P-O-N-I-E-W-A-Z, versus Regent Asset Management Solutions, Incorporated. And that is from the Eastern District of Missouri. And that is a 2010 case. Another one is Newsome, spelled N-E-W-S-O-M-E, versus Regent, R-E-G-E-N-T, Asset Management Solutions, Inc., which is the Middle District of Florida, from 2010. I'm going to give you one more. Henneberger, spelled H-E-N-N-E-B-E-R-G-E-R, versus Cohen, spelled C-O-H-E-N, and Slamowitz, spelled S-L-A-M-O-W-I-T-Z, LLP. And that's from the Western District of New York from 2010. So you can see there's a lot of good decisions here, very recent on this, on the emotional damages. For example, one court used the following jury instruction. First, actual damages may be awarded the plaintiff as a result of the failure of defendants to comply with the act. Actual damages not only include any out-of-pocket expenses, but also damages for personal humiliation, embarrassment, mental anguish, or emotional distress. And the case on that one, that specific case that listed that, and that's a good one, Smith versus Law Offices of Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L-N-K, K-A-Y, and that's from the District of Delaware, 1991. That's a really good one. The language there is fantastic. That really spells it out. All right. Several decisions from the Eastern District of California take the opposite approach and impose an FDCPA emotional distress and impose on FDC emotional distress damages the same requirements as state court standards to recover under an intentional infliction of emotional distress theory. Remember, there's going to be different circuits, different districts, where there's going to be some differential between some of these things. That's one of the things that we always got to watch for. you always want to read the case that is being cited. Make sure that you're not putting something in there where you're shooting yourself in the foot. It's very important. I'll give you a couple citations on this one. And this is one, like I said, that actually kind of goes the other way. And here again, when you read these things, sometimes you can learn from things that are adverse by making sure you don't state something or maybe do state something a certain way when you write it. Hartung, spelled H-A-R-T-U-N-G, versus J.D. Byrider, spelled B-Y-R-I-D-E-R, Incorporated, and that comes from the Eastern District of California from 2009. Another one is Bolton, B-O-L-T-O-N, versus Penta Group, spelled P-E-N-T-A-G-R-O-U-P. Financial Services, LLC. And that's the Eastern District of California. And that's from 2009. All right, these decisions can be criticized because Congress passed the FDCPA to overcome the inadequacy of state tort remedies. The FDCPA's findings and declaration of purpose states, quote, E, existing laws and procedures for redressing these injuries are inadequate to protect consumers, unquote. See, this is one where you got to look at the legislative intent. Representative Annunzio, the primary House FDCA sponsor, FDCPA sponsor, stated that passage of the Debt Collection Practices Act is important if consumers throughout this country are to be protected from the mental anguish and intimidation that are consequences of abusive debt collection practices. Courts are required to give the term actual damages a construction which will best accomplish the legislative purpose, which is specifically, quote, to eliminate abusive collection practices, unquote. The imposition of actual damages should be interpreted as a message to all debt collectors that such conduct is inappropriate. To not award actual damages would encourage a race to the bottom, as debt collectors could operate in an inappropriate manner with little consequence. And isn't that the truth? And there's a case citation for that. And see, you can mention these types of things and cite, when you're making an argument like this for your damages, if you're getting to the point where you're needing to make those arguments, here's one to back you up on that. It's Becker, B-E-C-K-E-R, versus Montgomery, M-O-N-T-G-O-M-E-R-Y, Lynch, L-Y-N-C-H. That comes from the Northern District of Ohio in 2003. At the time the FDCPA was enacted, case law under other titles of the Consumer Credit Protection Act, the CCPA, such as the Fair Credit Reporting Act, FCRA, and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the ECOA, had awarded damages for injury to the sensibilities or psyche without proof of the state tort elements for emotional distress. When Congress enacted the term actual damages in the FDCPA, it was aware of how the term was used in other pre-existing CCPA titles. Quote, where Congress borrows terms of art in which are accumulated legal tradition and meaning, it probably knows and adopts the cluster of ideas that were attached and the meaning its use will convey to the judicial mind. Okay, they're going by what they've been doing. I'll give you a couple case citations on this. Morissette, spelled Morissette, versus United States. And that is from 1952. And that, I believe, is a Supreme Court case. From 1952. And let's go to United States versus Merriam, Merriam. That's also a Supreme Court case cited here from 1923. There's even one back to 1911. I won't give that to you, though. For example, the availability of FCRA emotional distress damages without reference to state tort law requirements indicates a congressional intent to allow the same under the FDCPA. And I'm going to give you this. This is a case. This is a case we've already mentioned, but it's Smith versus Law Offices of Mitchell, N.K.K.A.Y. And that's a District of Delaware from 1991. Several United States Supreme Court cases also support the conclusion that damages for emotional distress should be awarded to injured individuals and that emotional harm should be compensated as an actual injury. In Gertz, spelled G-E-R-T-Z, versus Robert Welch, W-E-L-C-H, Inc. And that's a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1974, just so you know. A defamation case predating the FDCPA, raising First Amendment issues, the court did not define actual injury, but held that it was not limited to out-of-pocket loss. The court noted that the more common types of harm inflicted by defamatory falsehoods include loss of reputation and standing in the community, personal humiliation, and mental anguish and suffering. Gertz can be analogized to typical FDCPA cases in which embarrassment, emotional distress, and loss of reputation are commonly incurred injuries. In Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, versus Pippus, spelled P-I-P-H-U-S, that is a Supreme Court case from 1978. A procedural due process case brought under 42 U.S.C. section 1983, the court stated that distress is a personal injury familiar to the law, and that we use the term distress to include mental suffering or emotional anguish. The court thus defined actual injury to include a variety of psychological harms, as well as pecuniary loss and physical injury. More recently, in Doe, D-O-E, versus Chow, spelled C-H-A-O, the court noted that the circuit courts were divided on the issue of whether non-pecuniary psychological harms qualify as actual damages, as used in the Privacy Act, but declined to rule on the issue. And the Doe versus Chow is from 2004, and that is a U.S. Supreme Court case. The court did not suggest that out-of-pocket expenses are necessary for recovery. On claims, recovery on claims for actual damages, but the conclusory allegations of emotional distress with no corroboration did not rise to the level of actual damages. Now let me read that last part again. The court did not suggest that out-of-pocket expenses are necessary for recovery on claims for actual damages, but that conclusory allegations of emotional distress with no corroboration did not rise to the level of actual damages. In other words, you can't just say, oh, well, I was really nervous. You've got to be able to state how it affected you, that you lost sleep, that you were nervous, that you were became afraid to talk to your neighbors, you know, things like this. You were afraid you were going to be fired from your job because of what was happening. You've got to be able to state what happened. You can't just make a conclusion and say, well, I was harmed because they did that. That's not going to fly. All right. I'm going to go through one more here, and that's proof of actual damages. And that's going to round it up for tonight. Often in FDCPA cases, proof of actual damages is introduced into evidence only after the consumer has prevailed on a partial summary judgment motion on liability. By resolving liability issues first through a partial summary judgment motion, court and litigation resources are conserved, because proof of actual damages can be focused on those claims on which the consumer prevailed at summary judgment and not on the consumer's other claims. Non-pecuniary damages must be based on evidence. And I'm going to give you a couple of court citations here, several of them. Here again. Non-pecuniary damages must be based on evidence. The first one is Pipiles, spelled P-I-P-I-L-E-S, versus Credit Bureau, Inc. And that is a Second Circuit decision from 1989. Next one is Bassett, spelled B-A-S-S-E-T-T, versus I.C. System, Incorporated. That is from the Northern District of Illinois from 2010. Another real recent case. Another one is Crass, spelled C-R-A-S-S, versus Marvel, M-A-R-V-A-L, and Associates, LLC. That's from the Eastern District of Wisconsin from 2010. And I'll give you one more, which is Molina, spelled M-O-L-I-N-A, versus Creditors Specialty Service Incorporated. And that comes from the Eastern District of California in 2010. And again, those were relating to non-pecuniary damages must be based on evidence. For example, many of the cases cited in the previous subsection, such as Doe versus Chow, Carey versus Pippus, Gertz versus Robert Welch, Racer versus Retail Credit Company, and Schumann versus Standard Oil Company of California, hold that mental anguish and other injuries claimed as actual damages must be proved by competent evidence. Proof that a claimed injury occurred might consist of testimony of the consumer or of a witness that the consumer had or complained of a headache shortly after an offensive phone call. That's interesting. Okay, and I'm even going to give you a case citation. Reed, R-E-A-D, versus Amana, spelled A-M-A-N-A, Collection Services. And that is from the Western District of New York from 1991. And you want to read that, because the note here says, emotional distress damages not established by consumer's testimony. All right, you need to go read that and find out, okay, why weren't they established? What did they do wrong? Because they can give you a clue. Well, you didn't state that such and such and so, so you didn't state what was needed. Well, when you get something like that, it's telling you, okay, well, you need to make sure you state whatever it was that they left out. Evidence of the extent and duration of the injury should also be introduced. While it is the province of the jury to determine the causal link between the violation and the injury, it is usually critical to provide evidence of causation. You know, what caused it? Testimony regarding the value of some types of injuries, such as lost wages and property values, must also be introduced. Evidence of the value of pain or mental suffering is not required. The jury is guided in its determination by its own experience, by the arguments of counsel, and by the instruction of the judge. Okay, now I'm going to give you a couple of citations here. One is one that we've already mentioned a couple times, which is the Smith versus Law Office of Mitchell and K. Okay, you can look at Grassley, spelled G-R-A-S-S-L-E-Y. Versus Debt Collectors, Inc. And that is the District of Oregon from 1992. And then you have Carrigan, spelled C-A-R-R-I-G-A-N. Versus Central Adjustment Bureau, Inc. And that is from the Northern District of Georgia, 1980. And to finish up here, it says, a number of courts have held that expert testimony is not necessary to prove emotional distress damages. After all, aren't you the best person to speak to that? I believe you are. All right. Now, we are I'm going to give you several case citations there, and then we're going to wrap this one up. There's McNally, spelled M-C, capital N-A-L-L-Y, versus Client Services, Inc. And that is a Western District of Pennsylvania from 2008. That one says, consumers, testimony sufficient. And let's see, we'll go to DeGeorge, spelled D-E, capital G-E-O-R-G-E, versus LTD, Financial Services, LP. That is a Western District of New York case from 2008. And the note here is family members' testimony sufficient. And there is Nelson versus Equifax, E-Q-U-I-F-A-X, Information Services, LLC. That's from the Central District of California, 2007. Medical, and the note here on this is medical testimony unnecessary. And again, I'm only on some of these like this, I read just a part of the case citations that are here. And for all of you that are, you know, listening to this and getting this information, if at all possible, I would highly recommend that you set the money aside and purchase these books. These are the NCLC books. This one is from the Fair Debt Collection. I know it sounds a bit pricey. It's $180. My opinion, it's $180. Very, very well spent. And if somebody's going to be doing much of anything and you want to learn to protect yourself and deal with these situations, if you've got various things, I would very highly recommend you get this because it's an absolute wealth of information for you to be able to use for litigating against these people that are trying to take your money or oppress you. That's the bottom line. It's putting us on a level playing field so that we don't have to hire the lawyers. All right. That's going to do it for Education Hour tonight.